If you're a global warming alarmist, be alarmed. Be very alarmed. This is your weekly dose of common sense.
Hey everyone, Corey Bernardi here. Welcome to another weekly dose of common sense podcast. Great to have you tuning in. I love the fact that more and more people are tuning in every single week, which means the common sense message is getting out there. And don't I know it, because the feedback keeps coming through. We're going to cover that, a lot of that in your say. And needless to say, I didn't make everyone happy last week when I said that I actually like shooting. My goodness. Some people's reaction were really quite odd. Others, of course, said, yeah, they like it too. It's a good sport. Teaches discipline. It's mind control. It's breathing control. It actually takes a bit of skill. Anyway, we'll go through some of your feedback in that space. And we've got a lot of other stuff to cover as well. But I'm going to be joined on the podcast a little bit later on by a chap who would be familiar to many of you. His name is Chris Uhlman. He is a long-standing gallery journalist. He used to work for the ABC. He's now with Nine and Fairfax. We're going to talk a little bit about politics maybe and a little bit about the press gallery. But more importantly, he has been the canary in the coal mine about the growing impact of China on our culture, our values, and on our institutions. It is something that I know many of you feel very strongly about. We're going to cover that with Chris Uhlman, who's a really good guy. And I'm not going to say he's a conservative, but he's a person who has a healthy respect for the institutions that that operate in this country, which is great. And for our younger listeners, we're going to go back through memory lane a little bit. And the reason I'm saying it's for our younger listeners is because you probably have heard the term the recession we had to have. But you might not know how it came about. You might not know about the individuals involved in it and the circumstances, which were vastly different to what we find our economy today, but they might not be vastly different to our economy in the next few years. So we'll cover that briefly as well. And for those of you who are into the culture wars, I've got a special treat, because I'm going to discuss one of the cultural battles out there, and it's about our national pride, but it also ties in with one of my favourites. And this is going to cue the outrage again, because I actually like combat sports. I like boxing. I like MMA. And there's something happening this weekend that not only will we delight combat sport fans, but it will outrage those who want to protect and preserve our culture too. And of course, I've got to deal now with the Victorian election result. It was an astounding drubbing for the coalition. And I don't want to admit, or I won't accept, that it was a resounding endorsement of the agenda, the radical agenda that the Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews has put forward. I mean, the safe schools thing, this demonising of anyone who disagrees with his program of gender fluidity and et cetera, et cetera. His introduction of euthanasia, his radical attacks on the fire departments and so forth. But what Daniel Andrews has demonstrated is unapologetic leadership. He has said, this is what we're doing. He is going to pursue it. His critics have been cowed into silence, pretty much, because there was no real opposition in Victoria. I don't know Matthew Guy at all. Apparently he's a good guy. His agenda was certainly very mainstream. But if you want to get rid of a sitting premier, you've got to attack the policy with convictions. If you don't support safe schools, you've got to understand why you don't support it. Just not mouth platitudes about how it's wrong to teach, you know, three-year-olds that they can be a boy or a girl. It's wrong to talk about euthanasia unless you're going to have a conviction and principled conviction against it. And I know there's a lot of empathy for people having the right to end their own lives. But if you analyse any euthanasia system around the world or legislation, it has been abused, it's been misused, and that's the sort of objection that Matthew Guy should have been running. But in the end, it was leadership that won Daniel Andrews that election. And aren't we bereft of leadership at the federal level, at the Commonwealth level? Not only have we had three prime ministers in 3 years or whatever it is, we've got a small target Labor Party who are completely untroubled by anything that the coalition throws at them. The less they say, in fact, the more they win, because the coalition kicks own goals. And haven't we seen a bit of that this week? All of a sudden, we've got these cabinet ministers who are going on about we need to embrace the climate change agenda, we need to stop hugging coal or providing for coal jobs, we need to stop the culture wars. Why not just capitulate and give in to the left? And these are the same people, might I add, who tinkered with your superannuation, who are putting your taxes up, and then they try and put them down and rationalise it. They don't know whether they're Arthur or Martha. And that's why the country is in such a mess, because the people that are charged and entrusted with representing your interest in government haven't got a clue what they believe in. And you know, even if they pursued an agenda that you might disagree with, you'd respect them if they carried it through hell and high water, if they held onto it for more than 3 weeks, maybe 3 months, God forbid, 3 years. What about that? What about having a party built on principle? The Liberal Party used to be, but it's not anymore, and that's why I left. And it's why I started the Australian Conservatives, because we're not for changing. There are some absolute truths. There are some things worth defending. And if we're not going to protect our culture, our way of life, our values, our economy, and the future for our young people, and also care for those who truly need it by being good custodians and stewards of not only our financial circumstances, but our environmental standards and the quality of life that we've all enjoyed, then who is going to? Now, I don't know whether that's going to be a success or not, but what I know is that with your help, we can get the message out there. There is a genuine alternative. No matter who forms government, the Conservative Party holding the balance of power in the Senate will make them better. We will watch your back. We will look after your interests and the interests of all Australians, because we're united by that, and we've got no time for those that want to diminish our place in the world, our sense of self-belief, or these unalienable rights that are worth defending. Our freedoms are worth defending. That's what the Conservative Party is all about, and instilling a bit of common sense. And that's why you're listening to this podcast, because it is your weekly dose of common sense. I'll be back.
In an age of deals, excuses and shortcuts, it's time for a better way. Australia could really do with a new brand of politics. Someone that will say what they mean and mean what they say. A party that will never quit, never give up. And I know Corey Bernardi and his team of Conservatives will always fight for you. They will fight for affordable and reliable electricity. They will fight for stronger borders. And they will stand up to political correctness and defend our Australian values. Australia together. The Australian Conservatives can bring conviction back to Canberra.
Authorised by C. Bernardi for the Australian Conservatives, Adelaide.
Keep listening. This is your weekly dose of common sense.
Welcome back. It was a lifetime ago, 28 years this week, that the famous phrase, "This is the recession we had to have," was coined. And its author was none other than Paul Keating, our then Treasurer and later Prime Minister. One of the most divisive figures in politics, he knew how to dismember his opposite numbers with words. He was really quite an extraordinary performer, not always well-liked, but I think he was well-regarded as treasurer. But in 1990, he said, "This is the recession that we had to have." And you have to understand the economic environment that Australia found itself in at the time. I mean, right now, let's contrast it with where we are right now. The official Reserve Bank interest rates are something like 1.5%. Now, around that time in the 90s, the Reserve Bank interest rates were as high as 17.5%. Imagine that. Imagine the official bank reserve rate being 17.5%. Your mortgage rate was probably 19 or 20. And there was a system of capped home loans at the time where the lucky ones had their interest rates capped at 13%. It was much harder to get a home loan, might I add, then than it is now, certainly in the last few years. But these ills this rampant inflation was driven by a whole bunch of industrial action. It was driven by this stranglehold, I think, on most state administrations, in which wages kept rising, but productivity didn't improve. We had the Reserve Bank trying to stop inflation from getting even more rampant, and so they had these crippling high interest rates to, and I quote, break Australia's inflation stick. It was to get rid of the lingering 1970s era bad industrial habits out of our economy. And it was an extraordinary time, I remember, because businesses were being crippled. And it was seen by Paul Keating as a necessary adjustment, that our economic growth had to go backwards. And for those of you who aren't familiar with it, a recession is technically a second consecutive negative growth in GDP. And we haven't had one since the 1990s. Everyone thinks that, we can have unbridled growth. It'll continue to go on and on and on. And that's why governments want to continue with a high migration program, because they know that when more people come to this country, they consume more things, and so our economy continues to grow. And that has been masking the underlying problems within the Australian economy. We're going backwards individually. Per capita income has been diminishing as the economic pie has been growing. And that's because we've got the wrong mix of migrants, we've got too many migrants, we've got infrastructure problems, we've got productivity issues attached to all of this, and still your politicians don't want to do anything about it. They all have a vested interest in keeping the Ponzi scheme going. Well, we can't afford that anymore. And might I suggest to you that in the years ahead, we will face another economically difficult time. I don't know whether it's going to be a recession, but interest rates eventually have to rise. Your household budgets, your household debt will consume more of your take-home pay as those interest rates go up. Governments will have to pay more interest on the money that they've borrowed. And it's over $500 billion right now. And they'll have to pay more interest on that. And so how do they get that money? They take it from your taxes. So your taxes are likely to go up. This is a compounding catch-22 circumstance. Unless we rein in the debt, unless we live within our means, we are going to end up in a very parlous state. And if you think you're struggling to pay your bills now with interest rates on your mortgage at 5%, imagine what it's going to be like if it's at 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10%. And don't say it can't happen, because it can. 28 years ago, mortgage interest rates were in excess of 17.5%. Imagine what business interest rates were at the time. Don't say it can't happen again. Conservatives are mindful of history, because if we're not, you're doomed to repeat it. And we can't afford that. I'll be back.
Keep listening. This is your weekly dose of common sense.
Welcome back. This is your weekly dose of common sense. I'm Corey Bernardi, and I've got a secret. I'm going to share it with you. I like combat sports. I like watching boxing. I like watching MMA. And haven't we got an amazing weekend coming up? For those who do like mixed martial arts, the UFC has Fight Night in Adelaide. I'll be going. I bought a half a dozen tickets. I'm going to take a few mates and my kids and have a fantastic time. Well, we're going to see a great heavyweight bout. We're going to see Tai Tuivasa, who is an undefeated Australian, and he's going to be fighting a former UFC heavyweight champion, Junior Dos Santos. It's going to be taking place on Sunday morning in Adelaide, center of the fight universe on that day anyway. So I know, people are going to send me, how can you like the emails saying, how can you like this brutality and everything else? I like it. Please don't tell me what I can like and what I can't like. You don't have to like it either, but if you do, let me know. But there's also another fight on this weekend, and it's on Friday night. It's Jeff Horn versus Anthony Mundine. Now, many of you would know Anthony Mundine. He's the guy who, when the September 11 atrocities occurred and the Twin Towers fell, he was on, I think it was Channel 7 or Channel 9, saying, the Americans brought this on themselves. It's just nonsense. He says there's no homosexuals in in Indigenous communities, and on it goes. He's an outrageous, outrageous person who is a super talented sportsman, but has perhaps the most objectionable worldview that I know, apart from the Greens, I guess. But anyway, he has started the culture wars again, of course, because he's got brown skin, Aboriginal heritage, and he's a victim. Notwithstanding, he's a multi-time world champion and a super talented rugby league person. He's a victim, the victim of racism wherever he goes, because we don't like his attitude. Well, I don't like his attitude. I don't like him. I think, you know, I can recognise his talents, but I just think he's an objectionable personality. And he's going to do it again. He's going to be outraging Australians by refusing to stand for the national anthem this weekend. He says, oh, it's about white genocide or whatever he complains about. It's a white supremacist song. I'm over it. What are these people? Who are these people? Let them go in, do their sporting stuff, ease up on the political statements. Our values and our culture are what's important here. And, you know, we can have Indigenous people and new settlers all live, coexist side by side. I can recognise Indigenous people were on this land for many generations before white settlement occurred, but it's now our land. We all live together in it. We share it. The reason Aboriginal life expectancy has increased from where it was is because of white settlement. They have healthcare, they have welfare, they have opportunities that would never have come their way without settlement. Anthony Mundine seems to forget all of that. He just wants to be a perpetual victim as he's cashing in ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching on all of our money. I'm sick of the pious lecturing from these performers. You're given a bit of fame, you're given a bit of talent, and you're telling the rest of us what we're allowed to do. Celebrate your country, Anthony Mundine. It is our country. We celebrate your successes. Some of us will be cheering on for Jeff Horn, but that's not the point. We respect your abilities. You should show some respect to the country that gave you the greatest opportunities you could ever have. Let me know what you think. Corey at coreybernardi.com.
Do you reckon pushing Paris climate targets is cutting off your nose to spite your face? You're in the right place. This is your Weekly Dose of Common Sense.
Welcome back. This is the Weekly Dose of Common Sense, and haven't we got a treat for you right now? Listeners, I know I'm scathing of the press gallery, but they're not all bad people. Sometimes they're just bad at reporting accurately. Now, I'm not going to level that accusation at this chap, Chris Uhlmann, a former ABC type, reformed ABC, sort of weaned himself off. He's found his way into the Fairfax stable. Nine was too right-wing and they've merged with Fairfax to bring him in. No, that's not true. But Chris Uhlmann is one of the press gallery's most impressive reporters. He plays a straight bat to a lot of things. And one of the things that he's picked up before anybody else, and he's suffered for it, is a concern that I've shared with many of you over many, many weeks, and that is the influence of the Communist Party of China in Australia, not only in our business circles, in our educational circles, but also in our body politic and in our culture and the cover-up that's going on. Now, Chris Uhlmann, welcome. This is your Weekly Dose of Common Sense.
Thanks, Corey. Thanks for having me.
You're going to share some sense with us today. Is that right?
Well, look, I certainly agree with you that what we're talking about is the influence of the Chinese Communist Party in Australia, not just in politics, but in academia, and the influence that it's having over business, because, you know, it's the biggest show in town when it comes to cash nowadays, and not the Chinese-Australian community. We've got to separate those two things, although, of course, there is an effect on this Chinese-Australian community. So we've been looking at this for some time now, and I think over a long period of time, both at the ABC and now in Nine News, we've shown that the tentacles of the state, which is an oppressive authoritarian regime, it's a dictatorship now run by a man who will be president for life, are reaching inside Australia. We've seen what's happened in the South China Sea. China's occupied and militarised it. We now know they're looking for a naval base in the South Pacific. The concern that I have is that already we're seeing strong links into the Australian community to spread what is a very oppressive ideology.
But we know that in China the state is all powerful. But where is the line drawn between private business enterprise, because there are a lot of the diaspora that come out here and run big businesses and invest in Australia, Are they instruments of the party itself?
In China, everything now is in the service of the party, and really always has been, but it's becoming ever more explicit. And I'll give you some example, even of private companies from other countries, when they're operating in China, have to have a Communist Party cell inside. Now, Walmart, famously in the United States, doesn't have unions in its workplace, but it's got a Communist Party cell when it works out of China. So that shows you how other businesses, even American businesses, are accommodating the way that China wants to do its business. And we're seeing ever more pressure putting on private companies inside China to play ball with the Chinese Communist Party. We've seen a security law that's been passed, which says, for example, a company like Huawei, under Chinese law, is actually required to hand over information if the party asks for it. Now, the people in Australia will say to it, well, we obey Australian law, not Chinese law. Well, I put it to you that one of the reasons that our security officials have a huge problem with Huawei being inside our 5G network is because they believe that they know where the weight will be if the Chinese Communist Party ever comes calling for information on what's going on in Australia.
And in fact, the actual security laws that have been proposed by the government allow an exemption for a foreign company that is prohibited by their own laws to disclose information. And so, you know, it does seem to be catering to the Chinese community, which everyone up here in Canberra seems to be afraid to take on. The Communist Party is influencing so many aspects of what's going on in Australian society.
Yeah, and look, I think that Tony Abbott actually nailed it when he was asked by Angela Merkel what Australia's China policy was, and he says, well, we basically oscillate between fear and greed. And I think the real issue that we have is that we don't have a China policy. Look, it's within China's rights as it gets big to become a superpower, and we're not going to be able to stop that. It will expand, it already has, into the South China Sea. We've been proven to be unable to stop that through a combination of weakness and neglect in the South China Sea.
It was inaction. They denied it was ever going to happen. They accepted this. This is our government.
Yeah.
They accepted the promises of the Chinese it would never be militarised. And, you know, 6 months later, there's planes and bombers and threats to delay shipping. It's amazing that we fall for it.
Look, and what we see there too is that straddles our major waterway. Now, the argument, our major trade route. Now, the argument that's always put is, well, why would China harm itself by trying to cut that off? Well, we've actually seen that when Australia does not do what China likes, and let's look at what the Australian government last year was criticised roundly by the business community, by the academic community, for mishandling the Chinese relationship. Well, what did they do? Malcolm Turnbull made a speech critical of China and what it was doing in the South China Sea, simply stating Australia's foreign policy. All we were doing was say, we'd really rather you wouldn't do that. That was about the strength of it. And then after proof emerged through the Sam Dastyari case that there was a significant problem with foreign interference in Australia, the government moved to pass some laws to protect Australia, doing what China always says that we should do with it, and that's the principle of non-interference in our affairs. The government just laid down some ground rules. Now, apparently, according to the business community and the academics, that was mishandling the relationship. Australia's former ambassador to China, Jeff Raby, actually called on the foreign minister to resign for mishandling the relationship. Now, I thought that the government was acting in Australia's national interest.
But didn't we have this same thing? Maybe you're old enough to remember when the Communist Party and the Cold War was there and all that. I was growing up during that part. But wasn't there this bunch of Lenin's useful idiots that used to say, no, communism is just another form of government, there's nothing wrong with it, let it grow here and it'll all be okay. Are we seeing this sort of same useful idiocy when it comes to China? People who are profiting from it, the people who are benefiting from advocacy in the relationship with China, saying there's nothing to see here, we shouldn't be worried, and letting it go because it's in their interest.
Yeah, and I think there's a huge problem with that, and here's the big difference between the Cold War and now. At no stage during the Cold War was the USSR ever the US's major trading partner. At no stage was it ever our major trading partner. Now, for the first time in our history, a country that's not a liberal democracy is our major trading partner, and everyone is in hock to it. The entire business community, it would seem to me, at least if you go on what they say, our university sector would fall over now if it wasn't for international students, and particularly Chinese students.
Our tourism sector would be devastated.
Everything depends on it. Now, we've got to have a good relationship with China, but we also have to stand up for our own values. And the problem that I see is that China is essentially exporting its value system. What has a dictatorship got to worry about? Not us, its own population. And so it now is developing a police surveillance state to watch over its own population. But it's got a big export population. And by the way, they don't refer to them as Australian citizens. They will talk about the Chinese community here, and a lot of them are Australian nationalists, but they talk about them as the overseas Chinese. Mm. The concern that they have is that an infection spreads back from that community into their community. So they are watching the external Chinese community, not just in Australia, but around the world, as closely as they're watching their own. And they're in the process of exporting that oppression to the rest of the world. The business community in Australia, as far as I can tell, and again, what we didn't have during the Cold War was, there weren't a large group of people, business people in Australia, who were actually doing business with Moscow. There weren't a lot of people who were working for
Lee Rhiannon, maybe, yeah. But I can say that. I've said that to her personally. But it's true, actually. There was a difference. It was a big wall. Mm. There was an ideological advocacy on behalf of the Soviet Union by some, mm. but our entire economy wasn't dependent on it, was it?
No.
Whereas now, what happens if we don't deal with this now? What happens if we don't assert our sovereignty and independence in respect to China? It'll be probably the world's largest economic power in a decade or so. It'll control the South China Sea. It'll dictate terms to Australia.
And inside our borders. And that's the thing. I mean, I've given up on the South China Sea. I think we've lost that. Now we have to work out whether or not we can keep the South Pacific free of a Chinese military presence. I mean, that's what we would want now. With trading presence, fine. But we don't want them developing a base in our backyard, essentially. And it's been a stated foreign policy of Australia since the Second World War that we don't want that as a possibility, that there's a potential adversary perched on our doorstep.
Wasn't there a case where China lent money to a South Pacific nation to build a wharf? And, of course, they could never pay back the wharf, but the wharf happened to be big enough to berth a Chinese warship. It was too big for any other ship. Did you hear something like
yeah,
that?
So yeah, so in Vanuatu.
Vanuatu.
So what we're seeing is around the Pacific Islands, Chinese cash is flowing freely. They've got this project called Belt and Road, which is about building infrastructure. And, you know, as the Tibetan president in exile said to me, you know, there's the story with the Chinese. First the roads came, then the trucks came, then the tanks came. Economic infrastructure of this kind is strategic infrastructure. This is a big strategic play by China. It's the stated aim of the Chinese to push the United States out of the Western Pacific. Now, you know, that is our major ally, and our world order essentially has been written by the United States. China is in the process of rewriting the world order, and I don't know that the rules of that particular game are going to be something that we enjoy.
Yeah. Chris, you know, you may be aware that sometimes I've been critical of the ABC and even Fairfax Press on occasion, but you were a pioneer at the ABC in respect to this. Fairfax, I think, were involved in it and continue to be involved in it. Why aren't the rest of the media concerned about it? I don't want you to slight your colleagues, but why aren't they grasping this nettle?
Yeah, look, and I wonder sometimes why more of the country isn't awake to some of these really serious problems. We've provided an enormous amount of evidence, and as you say, going back to... So we have seen constant cyber attacks on our infrastructure. We're spending $250 million, although the government's never put a public figure on it, they've admitted it happened, to try and fix the damage that was done when China got into our Bureau of Meteorology. They got all your emails. They got the Australian Parliament House server. Mm. They were in here for quite some time before they were found. There are almost constant attacks on our intellectual property. So that's one area of it. We've seen political interference. We're seeing interference in our universities. So there's a lot of meddling here and interference in the Chinese diaspora as the Chinese... Beijing-focused Chinese, if you like, try to make sure that community groups line up with Beijing. All of the Chinese language media in Australia, except for one outlet, is got editorial control by Beijing.
Because that's where the cash comes from.
And, you know, the party is concerned that it has sort of a certain amount of overwatch over this community. So we're in the process, I think, by stealth of having our community changed. Look... I do think that over time, more people in the media have become aware of it. My real fear is that, in fact, that governments and agencies actually have been slow on the uptake. My fear, too, is that some government agencies don't really want to meet this challenge head on. And this is not to pick a fight with China. It's simply to say, look, we will live by the rules of the road that you want us to live by in your country. That is the principle of non-interference. Inside our borders, these are the values that we have. These are the values we want respected. We want the Chinese-Australian community's independence respected. Some of them may well choose that they sign up more to your way of seeing the world than our, you know, than the Australian government's way of seeing the world, and they're free to do that. It's a free country. But to stop meddling in our affairs would be a great start.
You know, what you said before about them getting control of or access to my emails, it probably explains why I haven't been invited to their embassy in recent times, because a lot of the common sense community are deeply worried about this. Some of the worries are not as rational as others, but there is a genuine sense of concern about foreign influence in our domestic life and what's going to happen for it. So the common sense community, I think, are ahead of the curve in this space. And I've got to say, you have been too. And I want to also say thank you for joining us. And I hope it won't be the last time you'll be on the Common Sense podcast.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers.
Take care.
Welcome to the home of the conservative revolution. This is your weekly dose of common sense.
Welcome back. It's time for that part of the podcast that everyone seems to enjoy and seems to provoke a strong reaction. It's your say. And we've got a pile of stuff to get through, so I'll get straight into it. Martin says he's considering supporting a new party. I've been through your web pages and your program, but couldn't find anything about utilities and healthcare. I'd like to ask a question. Do you consider utilities as standard goods, or do you recognise these basic monopoly and they need to be treated accordingly? Regarding healthcare, do you support privatisation of Medibank that effectively destroyed private insurance? Let me deal with the first one. Well, there are effective monopolies in some of the utility provisions. They're generally owned by government. Think about your water supplies and so forth. But in the electricity sector, we need more competition. Our policy in utilities in regard to electricity is for the government to get out of the way, stop the subsidies, stop dismantling the whole thing. In regard to healthcare, this privatisation of Medibank, there's never been a proposal for that. As far as I can tell, there was a Medi-Scare campaign run by the Labor Party, which was very dishonest at the last election, but they haven't privatised Medibank, and private health insurance is still available, albeit the incentives for it are diminishing, and I think that's very dangerous. Jason's also got a question about the health system. Enjoy the podcast. I only discovered the AC in the last few months. Wondering your thoughts on a change to Australian healthcare towards mostly or solely a privatised system. That is not happening. It's not happening. The public health system in this country consumes, I think, $30 or $40 billion a year. We have probably the best public health system almost anywhere in the world. But I do think there is a place for private healthcare because the public system is never going to be able to manage it whilst people don't want to take some responsibility for themselves. So the blend is probably the best as it is now. Neville says, I totally agree. Keep up the good work. Yeah, I'm loving these emails so far. How is it looking in regard to the Indonesian Free Trade and Open Border Agreement? What is the status of the petition that you're backing? It needs more coverage. Do you think Morrison is being straight up? Well, let's deal with it. Free trade agreements are good. I don't agree with open border agreements, particularly between Indonesia and Australia. But I'm not going to take any lectures from the Indonesians about where we can place our embassy in Jerusalem or not, or in Israel, I should say. Les says the UN Migration Pact, the Prime Minister's referral of a flawed agreement involving immigrants and welfare payments. I'm trying to find out what he's referring to, and so on and so on. Luke's also got a question in this regard. I received notice the PM will not be signing the Migration Pact, but still intends to sign its sister, the Refugee Pact. That's true, and that's what we're working on now. We've put pressure on the government to get out of this UN Migration Pact. We don't want the Refugee Pact. In fact, we should be revisiting the 1954, I think, Refugee Agreement, because it's not helping us at all. Luke also says, I believe the UN says no purpose anymore. I have to agree with that, mate. It is rife with corruption and the Paris Climate Accord brings no benefit to our country. Yes, yes, and yes. I do hope our government will pull out of the accord and any association with the UN, just as Donald Trump has done. Well, let me correct you there a little bit, Luke. Donald Trump hasn't withdrawn from the UN. He stopped funding it to the same extent that it was. They are still part of the UN Security Council. They still participate in there. But he tells them what's wrong. And they should listen to him. We should tell them what's wrong too. Colin says, am I not keeping up with world events? Last night, the ABC, there was an item about elections where they referred to Taiwan as China's breakaway state. Who at the ABC has decided this is Taiwan's status, I wonder? Well, this is a vexed issue. I recognise Taiwan as a sovereign nation. But to appease the Chinese, Australia doesn't recognise them as an independent thing. And many countries around the world don't. They recognise it as, you know, a one China policy. And that's called diplomacy. The ABC, of course, they march to their own beat. They decide what they want about world affairs, who's right and who's wrong. And, yeah, they're always right. Warren says, I'm a supporter and will be voting Conservative. If you put a candidate in Pine's seat, you need to launch out now. Every by-election from now on, run a candidate. A recent poll said 2% of people identify with Conservatives. That won't increase until you launch out. If not, others will take Conservatives' votes. Okay, Warren, here we go. We're running in the Senate. You can vote for a Conservative in the Senate. I'd desperately like to run in Christopher Pine's seat to try and unseat him and make his life miserable. But we have to think practically about what we can achieve and what we can hope to do. One, we don't have the capacity, the resources to launch 150 candidates around the country. It's counterproductive in many respects. And if I were the coalition, I would launch a campaign saying, don't vote for these people because it is going to result in a shortened government. I want to avoid that. And if you try and explain preferences to people, as I have so many times on this podcast, they still don't get it. So what do you want me to do? Run in Pine's seat and preference Labor and then have all the Liberals going, oh, look, you're just the Labor stooges? Or do you want me to run in Pine's seat and direct preferences towards Christopher Pine, an individual whom I think is unworthy of being in the Parliament? You see the conniptions it throws us into? You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. Best thing you can do, get an independent to run in Christopher Pine's seat and vote for the Conservatives in the Senate. Thank you, Warren. Come back to me with your views. I understand them. Andy says he's enjoying the podcast as always. Good on you. I was wondering if you've read Stephen Harper's new book, Right Here, Right Now. The answer to that is no, I haven't, but I have tremendous respect for Stephen Harper. He's done an amazing thing by taking, you know, the Progressive Liberal Party or whatever it was in Canada to the Conservative Party. He was a great Prime Minister of Canada. And after a decade, was shamefully replaced with this Trudeau person. Anyway, that's democracy, isn't it? Every chance I get, he continues, I get to discuss the Senate aspirations with Australian Conservatives, with friends, families and colleagues. One thing I've noticed is in my personal circles of influence is that young people in general seem to have an aversion to you and conservatism as a movement. You know what, Andy? You're right, mate. They tend to, but a lot of them make judgments about me based on media headlines and they haven't got really an idea about what my policies are or me as a person, but that's one of the things you have to overcome. They've been indoctrinated. You have to understand this. They've been indoctrinated right through their school life, through their university lives. They get told that, you know, climate change is, or carbon dioxide is destroying the planet, that people like me are just terrible or phobes and isms and, you know, whatever it is. And when you confront them with it, when you say, what is it specifically? And you ask them to drill down into some facts and some details, they can't answer it because they can only talk in platitudes. Oh, we need to stop CO2 from 350 parts per million. Why? They don't understand history. They don't understand commerce. They think that communism and socialism is more effective and better than capitalism. That's what the statistics show. They don't like democracy. They don't understand the concept of freedom. They just understand this concept of rights and entitlements and identity politics. It's wrong. But the counterculture movement among the young people is growing. The people who are resisting this indoctrination and saying, hang on, something's not right. You're a bloke or you're a woman. You can't be both. And you can't shape-shift between them. There are people out there, young people, who are more conservative than ever before. And they're growing. So we're going to keep fostering those people. That's what I've tried to invest in for many, many years through my foundation. I'm going to keep doing that. But Andy finishes up. He says, I'd be particularly interested to hear from some younger conservatives about how they connect with their peers when arguing for a conservative approach to politics. Need all the help I can get. Mate, let's do that. Let me find some young conservatives and we'll interview them and see what we can do. Ozcon's ages. Alan says he was handing out how to vote at the Vic election. And they're mostly senior in years, with some as young as 50 or 60. You know what? I used to think that 50 was old, but I'm not that far away from 50 now. Next year is the big 5-0 for me, so it's young. Anyway, after several reds, I was having a debate with some of the younger people there, that's the 50 to 55-year-olds, regarding policy. They were all anti-coal, made the observation my generation with our conservative views passed on. There'll be no one left who wants to see a coal-fired power station. They're all for renewables and batteries. I'm not surprised about that, Alan. Everyone loves the idea of renewables until they realise they have to pay twice for them. They have to subsidise them and then purchase the expensive electricity and that they don't work. These same people whine when the electricity's not on in their house. People do not understand the issues. They're emotionally attached to all of these things because that's all that's been broadcast. And then they don't want to stand in the way of the zeitgeist. Anyway, Alan says, what would be the average age of the AC party? Roughly what would be the age ranges of the party? Well, Alan, I think our youngest member's 15. The oldest is something like 102. He joined a party for the first time at 102. It's extraordinary. The average age, I couldn't even hazard a guess. It's probably in the 50-plus age group. But I fall into that now too. So it's young. Gun training feedback, here we go. Didn't it cause a stir? And some people were very rude, I have to tell you. You know, one man wrote to me abusing me and saying, I'm not going to read his email out, but basically saying guns are evil. And I responded saying, well, how can an inanimate object be evil? To which he got mighty upset. Anyway, people don't like dealing with truth anymore. Elizabeth says it's worth investigating how the nation of Iceland manages gun control. Very hard for anyone to acquire a gun license. There are many checks and balances in place because it's not easy or simple. They have a few gun accidents per year, something Australia could learn from. Well, Elizabeth, I think Australia has a pretty rigorous process of getting a gun license, and we don't have that many gun accidents per year either, in actual fact. And many times, the people who do cause problems with guns are unlicensed and they're illegal firearms. So having checks and balances and making it even more difficult won't solve those problems. But thanks for your feedback. John says he was in the RAF for 21 years, became a marksman with both rifles and pistols, gave him range officer qualifications, which he did considerable training to obtain. He now works in security. He joined the Army Reserves. During his whole shooting life, I've never heard of any incidents that involved injury or death except at live firing ranges in the military, never anywhere else, because of the training everyone received from professional trainers. The Army trains people to be instructors at their job and are particularly anal about range qualifications and shooting control. You know what, John? I've found that even the range that I've been to, and I'm not that great experience, but they are big on safety as well. There have been some incidents there, mostly suicides, I regret, and unfortunately it's a traumatic thing for anyone. So they've put some steps in place for that. But once again, we come back to this. Licensed gun owners, people who undertake guns or shooting as a sport, are not the problem we have. The problem we have is illegal guns, the illegal use of guns, and the misuse of guns by bad people. As I come back to it, guns are not evil. They're inanimate objects. They're machines that can be misused, just like cars. And this is the point you make, a point here. In Queensland, learner drivers must obtain 100 hours of supervised driving. And I think that's a good thing. That's what they do in South Australia too. But it also means that anyone with a full license is automatically qualified to advise a learner on driving skills and road rules without ever having completed a kind of instructional training. Most drivers do not know a huge number of the road rules, and that includes professional drivers. This is a really interesting point, isn't it? A car is a deadly weapon when misused. And yet, we allow the unprofessional, meaning mum and dad, to instruct their children. Now, we know there's an incentive to teach them good habits and to keep them safe because they're our children. But But stupid driving habits cost lives, just like stupid firearms handling. So there's some common sense that's necessary. John doesn't think so. He thinks what the world needs now is more gun-toting fanatics. Not. Wasn't it Mao Zedong who said democracy comes out of the barrel of a gun? Is that the path you want to take us down, old-timer? Old-timer, thanks, John. If I want to vote for a politician wielding a sidearm in our parliament, I'll vote for the Shooters Party. Well, see, here we go, John. This is another irrational contribution. There's no talk about politicians wielding sidearms in our parliament. The Shooters Party doesn't even want that. Or Fidel Castro, or Yasser Arafat. Both of them whom are dead, by the way, John. Good on you. Is that how you see yourself? Come on, brother, Corey. I'm not your brother, mate. And if you've got this sort of attitude and you get with this sort of rhetoric, you know, you're not even a fellow traveller. Step away from the gun. Turn the other cheek. Oh, goodness. Thanks, John. Move on. Family law. Susan says, just on the subject of silk circling the wagons around the judiciary. When are laws coming in about false accusations of domestic violence? When are penalties going to be made for these false accusations? Good point. Very good point, Susan. People can make all sorts of outrageous allegations now, which you have to defend yourself from, and then they get away scot-free. We see it on the Human Rights Commission. We see it in the courts. We see it in the family law environment. Let me get a briefing on that. Rob is an AC member. On the issues raised in your reference to the book from US Senator Richardson, great insights indeed. Yes, we need to become more engaged in the battle and expose the fallacies of the other side, but by means other than those they operate in. If winning by means that they use causes us to operate like them, then I would rather stay disengaged. But if we respectfully argue our case, make peaceful stands, expose them when and where we can, then I'm in. I'm sure you would agree with this, but I just want to make the point that we should operate on a more honourable level when making a stand. I'm a believer in what you sow is what you'll reap. Your thoughts, please. Well, Rob, in an ideal world, yes, and we never want to lose our principles and we never want to diminish ourselves and our standing and our values, but we're not winning. We're not winning. And in order to beat them, we have to understand their techniques. And their techniques, as I demonstrated last week or read out last week, there's nothing inappropriate about that. It says they make ambit claims, they meet some resistance, they retreat a little bit, and settle for half of what they originally wanted. And we think that's a win? It's not. We've gone backwards. We need to do the same thing. We need to call them out every single opportunity. Please, read the book. Read the book. There is nothing wrong with what they're suggesting we do. It's time we won. We are the voice of common sense. We cannot let them get away with undermining our values and our culture, our way of life, our traditions, our social mores any longer. Call them out on it. Get involved. Do not be disengaged. Another John says, you're not joining one of those fanatical religious cells, are you, Corey? Please tell me you're not going to go on an armed crusade against anyone who doesn't hold the same beliefs as you. It's so easy to become radicalized these days. Oh, John, I think my staff put this in just to make me laugh because you can't be serious. You're obviously a troll. Good on you, John. Troll somewhere else. Heather says, today, LNP Senator Amanda Stoker, who doesn't appear to be a bad person, I have to say. She's got good values. Has confirmed the APRA laws passed in February 18. Yes, they did. These are full bail-in laws. It means that if the banks run out of cash, they can take a bit of your coin out of their bank account to save them and keep them solvent. It's what Cyprus did. Yes, they're not good. Heather wants me to investigate and re-examine the legislation. Sorry, Heather, can't do it. This has already happened. Garth says, like they say, a week in politics is a long time, but the last week has been fruitful. Been informed. Oh, so same thing about it, Senator Amanda Stoker. They have passed these bail-in laws. Yes, we're fully informed. We're now in the loop, and we know that this is what the government has done, even though they denied it. Even though they're denied this would ever be used and so on, but I've had this discussion many times over the years. Ellie says, I've had this thought on my mind ever since I've moved from New Zealand to Australia. With all the terrorism, crime in the world, I've wondered, is there such a thing as an entry declaration form to sign when you enter a country or go through immigration to swear and declare if you break the law committing a crime that you can be deported immediately or when proven guilty? Well, yes, there is. It's the law of Australia. When you enter here and you come for a visa, you agree to abide by the laws and conditions of it. And if you commit a crime, you'll be deported unless you're a citizen. Or maybe a New Zealander, actually. No, we've deported some New Zealanders too. Or something to that effect, anyway, she goes. I wonder if it would make a difference to people's behaviour, just go in one ear and out the other. The people who want to break the law, who are going to break the law, don't care about signing false declarations. They don't give a hoot about that. They'll just keep going with what they want to do. So we need to be more rigorous in our screening and more intolerant of those who want to break us down. David says, there's another South Australian. Do you think SA needs more immigrants? Seriously, goes on about water, about natural disasters, about satellite cities and so forth. Well, David, look, in an ideal world, South Australia would have more people settled in it. It would give us more economy of scale. But we don't have the resources. We don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the jobs. We don't have the facilities. And so why do we want to become more congested like Melbourne or Sydney? There's huge issues at work, but Australia's migration program is just too high. It's not working for us. I've said it again and again and again. Carol says, thank you for your newsletters. Sometimes they make me very cross. Anyway, David was an announcer on 2RE. School teachers have been ringing to say the headmasters have been telling them to take down the Australian flag. That's outrageous. Outrageous. And unfortunately, I've targeted a couple of schools where they're flying the Aboriginal flag, or they even had an Islamic flag and they wouldn't fly an Australian flag. They changed that when the press got in touch with them. Look at this craziness that GetUp has sent me, says Elizabeth, making kids go on strike. It's madness. What do you think? This is about GetUp, the ACT government and others encouraging kids to go on strike, to take a day off school, to protest the climate change emergency. Well, I'm saying, as our numeracy and literacy standards are crashing, our teachers should actually do some work. Do their jobs, teach our kids, and the kids should be demanding to fix the literacy and numeracy emergency, because unless they can read and write, they're not going to have a decent future. And that's common sense. That's your say for this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be back in a minute.
Enjoying your weekly dose of common sense? Chip in at conservatives.org.au.
Friends, that's all we've got time for, and in fact, we've run overtime once again. But I hope you don't mind, because I enjoy bringing this podcast to you. I really think we cover some substantive issues. I'm trying to inform and entertain at the same time, because we've got to get the common sense message out there. And you know what? You don't have to be a rusted-on conservative to want to instill a bit of common sense in our body politic or in Australia, full stop. So recommend this podcast to your friends, to your family. It doesn't matter whether they agree or disagree with what the Australian Conservatives Party is doing or what I say or do. It's about challenging the zeitgeist, because unless we start pushing back, we are going to lose what makes this country so good. So thanks for tuning in. This has been another Weekly Dose of Common Sense.
This is your Weekly Dose of Common Sense with Corey Bernardi.